Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about virology to a certain extent. We've got an expert. His name is Professor Michael Rossman. He's a professor of biological sciences at Purdue University, and we're going to learn a lot about viruses and where they come from, why they mutate to keep giving us new horrible viruses that we've got to deal with, et cetera, et cetera. So, Michael, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you for your welcome.
Before we get into viruses and how you got into them, let's begin right at the beginning. Why are you a scientist? What were those formative years that suddenly said, science is for me?
Well, when I was in school in England, we had a science teacher. I wouldn't actually call him a particularly good science teacher in retrospect, but he certainly got me very interested in science. And the first thing we did with when I, in the particular class I was in, we learned about the, what's it called? Phlogiston, that's it. And so we started doing science, and also he introduced us to calorimetry. That's where you measure heat being added to some water in a little bucket, and you could weigh the water and how much temperature was needed to bring it to a certain temperature. You could calculate the calories needed to heat it up a degree or two, or how much energy was needed to evaporate it. And so I got very interested. Now, I don't think the other boys and girls in the class were that interested. It was just one of the regular classes, like any school. We learned science. But I got very fascinated, and school had a science lab of more, well, yes, really chemistry and physics and everything. This teacher, by the time I got into the sixth form, which means the sort of senior years, he needed someone to help him look after all the things, and he asked me to do that, and I was very happy to do that. So every evening I would clear up the lab and put out new equipment for the next day.
All right, lovely. Do you remember his name?
Pumphrey, Mr. Pumphrey.
Have you ever got in contact with him years ago? Because he's probably dead by now.
Oh,
right?
He's probably
right.
Long dead.
Did you actually ever go back to the school and say,
yes,
you know what, Pumphrey, you were a good thing for me?
I have been back to the school many times in what we call, it's an alumni meeting, but we call it old scholars meetings.
You probably the old boys association was my school in Wimbledon.
Yeah.
We meet every year in the Strand.
I see we're boys and girls.
we didn't have girls. We were an old boys school.
We were co-educational.
But anyway, so that was the beginning.
That was certainly the beginning. Right. And then by the time I was ready to go to college, which is another long story, I was set on studying physics and mathematics. Well, I don't think this is a place to go into all the details, but I eventually found a place in a college in London called the Regent Street Polytechnic. But the point is that a certain Dr. Topping was the head of that department, and he was familiar with some of the people who had worked with at school, and he took me as a student with a lot of other people. Most of the students at that time were people had just been demobbed, came from the army because it's just end of the war. And so most of the people with whom I worked were considerably older than me.
And more experienced.
And
it made you feel like you were still in school.
They were very nice to me. And actually, some of them became very lifelong friends. One guy called Terry Smith, with whom I still communicate with his widowed wife today.
So anyway, after this, you got a degree from Glasgow, correct?
No, my bachelor's degree was from University of London. It was actually an external degree from the University of London, because that's what the Polytechnic did. I can explain that more, but it was an external degree in physics and mathematics. Actually, two degrees, what was called general physics, and then a special physics degree. And then I got a job. I liked what I was doing in that same polytechnic as an assistant teacher and also as a student. I did a master's degree under the guidance of one of the people there, measuring vapor pressure, so it wasn't very interesting. And I realized it wasn't very interesting. I got a job as a lecturer at a similar institution, which was that time called the Royal Technical College in Glasgow. So I became a lecturer there, and I actually lectured huge classes, a few hundred people, in the basics of electricity and magnetism. But I wasn't very satisfied with what I was doing in Glasgow. I was finishing my master's degree in the first place. But I, through my school in where I had been in what's called high school in Britain, in America, I knew of a scientist. Her name was Kathleen Lonsdale. She was on the school committee, and I got to know her. Because in one year, she gave the school about 5 tickets for the annual Christmas lectures at the Royal Institution. And I was one of the chosen few who could do that. And it was a wonderful experience. That year, the Astronomer Royal was talking about navigation, which fascinated me.
I went to one of those. It was Lawrence Bragg.
Lawrence Bragg, I know him personally. Yeah.
And
Sir Lawrence.
It was wonderful because the demonstration that he did was he had a big barrel of sand in the front and then activated an air activation.
You got to see the waves.
And then up floated the duck.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
That was just, I liked that very much. And he
was a wonderful teacher,
yes.
I know.
You know, those people had the gift of not only knowing the science and being creative,
certainly Sir Lawrence.
They had that enthusiasm for communicating.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Very definitely, yes. Yeah.
Well, let's move on because I want to get on to what you do now, really. But you studied in Cambridge, right?
Well, no, I got this job as a teacher in Glasgow.
Right.
I was not satisfied, and for reasons which are too long to explain, obviously, I got in contact with the professor of chemistry at the university in Glasgow. And so I was able to do a PhD under him, that I was doing the research in Glasgow, earning my money as a teacher at the Technical College, and they're about 3 miles apart, still are.
That's nice.
It's now called the University of Strathclyde. So I got my PhD in 3 years, and then I followed fashion and came to America, did a postdoc in Minnesota with a later Nobel Prize winner, Bill Lipscomb. After I left Minnesota, he left also and went to Harvard, and he's now dead.
Oh, he's very famous. Some people used to call him the Colonel.
Exactly. He was the Colonel.
Right,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes. He had a bow tie.
A small world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's jump to the end because I'd like to get on to what your
virology. Where does virology come in?
Right.
Well, I was a mathematician. I was interested in mathematics. And the challenge in crystallography, which is what I was doing with in Glasgow and in Minnesota, is a mathematical challenge. And I knew that in Cambridge, Max Perutz and John Kendu were working on proteins, which was, I could quickly see this is the challenge of could ever anybody have. I knew nothing about the biology, what they're doing. I'm totally ignorant, still am. So I wrote to Max Perutz, and he happily accepted me, and later I discovered that the reason he so quickly accepted me because nobody else wanted to work with him because
he had a bad reputation.
No, he had a very good, nice reputation, but they thought what he was doing isn't really science. He was more intuitive in the way he did things. But anyway, I joined Max, and he was working on, for all his life, working on the structure of hemoglobin, the oxygen carrier in the blood. And so I got interested in why hemoglobin. I went to a few undergraduate lectures in Cambridge and I didn't really learn very much. But I was there at the critical time. I was able to do all the mathematics required to solve that structure. By the end of my first year in Cambridge with Max Perutz, we had determined the structure of hemoglobin at...
So you're on the original paper?
Yes.
That's lovely. I didn't realize that. I haven't looked up your vita sufficiently assiduously.
Yeah, and that as you know, it was very interesting because John Kendu, who was a student of Max Perutz, had been working on a much smaller molecule called myoglobin, the oxygen carrier in muscles. And about the same time, he got a structure of myoglobin. And this is actually, it's a sad story in some ways, but I actually found that hemoglobin consists of 4 rough copies of myoglobin, as you probably know. And I continued being interested in, you know, all, how to do these things, a subject now called, I guess, or then called protein crystallography, structural biology today. And I was just there at the right time, fortunately, and I did most of the developing of the kind of techniques which are used today in this very popular subject today.
You know, that hemoglobin molecule with the four different segments.
I can show you slides on it. Yeah.
They don't go over well on radio.
No, they don't,
right?
Sorry.
But what I was going to say is that when I first learned about that, when I first came here, I taught a class in bioinorganic chemistry.
Yes.
And just emphasizing the importance of metals, because that's what
yes,
I like.
Yes, yes.
But the cooperativity, where
yes,
the first
yes,
oxygen
that
binds
is what interested
and
Max.
Makes the second one yeah. easier.
Yes,
the third,
exactly,
and the fourth,
yes.
And then vice versa
yes.
when they have to go.
Well, much of understanding that, the Bohr effect is called, came after I had left Cambridge, because that was a real one of the basic interests. But the first thing you had to do is determine the structure. That's where I was involved.
Right.
So
and that's what you've been doing effectively ever since, in one form or another.
Determining structure. But
yes,
with the time...
Of big molecules.
You know, when I came to Cambridge, and even when I was, when I was in Minnesota and all that, to me, science was a set of puzzles, like a crossword puzzle, which had to be solved. What Max Perutz actually taught me is that there's much more to science. It's understanding of the world around us. And gradually, with time, I really became very, very interested in this. So when we let's jump here, when we want to do it now, it's always, why does it work and how does it work? Why? What can you do with this? How does it give them that more basic understanding? But there's a thing I jumped here that, working in Cambridge, I then learned something, a smattering of what virus is, and I could see that's the next challenge. During the time I was in Cambridge, I realized I wanted to work on viruses, not because viruses were interesting things which kill people or whatever they do, but because it was a structural challenge how this semi-living object,
right,
which you could crystallize and dissolve. And
if you're lucky. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is Michael Rossman, Professor of Biological Science at Purdue University. And we're going to now be talking about viruses. We will take a short break. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Michael Rossman from Purdue University. And so we've sort of segued into viruses. Before we go any further, you just made semi-living, I think, or some expression you used. Tell the audience, as simply as you can, as if you're telling your grandmother, what is a virus from your perspective?
Well, there are two questions there. What does semi-living mean and what is a virus? First of all, what is a virus? Classically, it's defined as an object, something other, didn't know what it was, which could pass through the smallest known filters and could be infectious after passing through the filters. So nobody knew what a virus at that point, at that time of definition, in the 30s, 1930s. Nobody had any idea what it looked like, what it was. And we do now have much, much, much better idea. But semi-living, well, when you say semi-living, you have to define what is life. What makes something living? And it's usually defined as something which can reproduce. Well, they get lots of problems with that definition because, for instance, a fire can reproduce itself somewhere else. But that is basically the definition. And a virus cannot reproduce itself without a host. It needs something living to reproduce itself. It has to infect something which is living, and it uses the machinery of that living object to replicate itself and then to assemble itself, and then to leave its host and go and find another host and replicate itself again. So in that sense, a virus is not living.
As long as the host is living, the virus is doing well.
Yeah.
It doesn't want to kill the host.
But it actually, yes, that's a good point. Viruses actually try to avoid killing their host, because if they kill their host, they die themselves.
Right, exactly. But they don't think, do they? At least I hope
that's a good
don't.
Question.
You know, let's just jump in. I mean, in the last 5-10 years, there's always a new virus being found, and it's always going to have tremendously bad effects on Homo sapiens, on us. Now the current one is the Zika virus. Where do they come from, these new ones? Presumably there's some form of mutation of an old one, but are we any closer to being able to predict where is a new one going to crop up?
No.
Okay.
They just crop up. And as you said, they're probably a mutation, mutated virus or something like it. And then you have to think about evolution. Yeah, evolution is just the passage of one object. It modifies itself. It lives a bit better, and so it continues to modify itself. And that's how what viruses are, which have obviously evolved together with their hosts, who are also changing at the same time. So the viruses are constantly evolving along with the host. In the case of Zika virus, well, humans can be the host, not the only host.
And that's an interesting thing. What other hosts are there for the Zika virus?
Well, it was isolated from monkeys, for instance,
in the first place. Does the effect on the monkey the same as that on... I mean, do they have issues with birth defects, for example?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
Well, it's when you say isolated, you look at what the virus is, what this thing is, which has...
So it was isolated in monkeys before it was found in humans?
Yes.
So we knew it was out there, but we never seen
well,
it transmitted.
Well, we knew it was out there. We knew it was in monkeys. It was first, well, maybe it was in humans at the same time, but it takes its name from having been found in the monkeys in the Sika Valley of Uganda.
So it was known, and then was it a surprise to you and your colleagues in virology that it would suddenly jump into human beings?
Well, I didn't know anything about Zika. Never heard of Zika virus until maybe a year ago. Other people had isolated. Actually, I think it was first isolated in the 1950s.
Yeah, so it's been out there a long time in our lifetime scale.
We have the same sort of story for the AIDS virus, HIV.
Right.
But it's something's changed, some mutations, and it takes off, and it's very happy with the new mutation. And
talk about that just for a moment. I mean, is there a mutation that permits it to jump? I mean, if you were to go back, and I know we'll come to that in a minute, you've done some structural analysis of this Zika virus that we're dealing with now. Had people looked at the Zika virus before in terms of structure, the ones that came from monkeys?
Well, they looked at the in the sense
structurally,
of...
Structurally, I'm talking.
Not structurally, no.
Okay. So we can't tell if it's the same...
Well, Zika virus is, belongs to a family of flaviviruses, a family of viruses, I think, which are all very similar. For instance, when you get a common cold, next time you get another common cold, it's not probably not the same virus. All these different viruses which give you cold are similar in structure. They're all the same kind of beasts. But they're not exactly the same. And Zika virus belongs to what they call flavivirus. Flavivirus are called flavivirus. Flavi means yellow in Latin. And the first kind of flavivirus-like object, which was isolated, is yellow fever virus, which was very significant pathogen when the Panama Canal was being built. And the first time a French engineer tried to build it, they had to stop it because too many people were dying of yellow fever virus and malaria also.
Oh. So let's get on then to a little bit. So this jumping from monkeys to humans, this is something one doesn't know why it suddenly cropped up. I mean, that's one of the riddles of
Well,
biology.
Things are changing all the time.
Yeah.
And everything biologically.
And so it's not a surprise when these new things come about.
You expect
that we know nothing.
To
you
change.
Expect them.
Yeah.
Which is not... it's not something to look forward to, is it? Let's just go to the structure that you have been studying for the last year, and I gather you're saying it's part of a larger family. So the very fact that there presumably were structures of other viruses within the family known, did that make it easier for you to determine the structure of the new Zika
yes,
virus?
Yes, it was very helpful. We actually, at Purdue University, were the first to determine the structure of any flavivirus. And so we've been studying flavivirus a long time. Our first paper on the subject is 2002 on dengue virus, dengue is a tropical disease, which is rapidly spreading, a great problem now. And Zika virus is very similar to dengue. We had learned certain properties about dengue virus, particularly how dengue virus matures. I can say more about that, but that process is rather a difficult process for dengue virus. Zika virus has the same problems. So when we got into certain problems of purification of the virus, we knew all about it and we could take action to to help us deal with this problem, and that then helped us in determining the structure. Without that earlier knowledge, it would have taken us much longer.
So if you can now look back in hindsight of a few months since you've had the structure, what's the key difference? Is it just one segment?
Key difference between what and
between
what?
The structure of the Zika virus and previous viruses in the same family?
Oh, yeah. We actually, when we published our paper on Zika virus March, we emphasized the what we considered and still consider the great importance. If you compare two structures, there was one part where it was obviously different. And that part, we also had reason to think that was involved in the part of the virus which first recognizes its host. And therefore, this is the part where the virus would recognize its host and recognize, say, the fetus in a woman. But there's the other question is, how does it get across the placenta, which we really don't understand at all at the moment.
So when you say that there are the family of viruses, is it always that segment that you were talking about, which is modified to provide it with a new host target, so to speak?
Or can
that be anywhere in the structure?
In a family of viruses, you could say, in humans, we might compare, maybe not quite the same, ethnic similarities. So we have Chinese-looking people, African-looking people, white-looking people. They have certain characteristics. And the same with viruses. They have basically the same, but they have differences, and that does change the character in which they have.
Tell us from the point of view of public health, because I'm sure a lot of your funding to do the work that you do
absolutely.
Comes from the National Institutes of Health, and they have a very clear mandate, the improvement of the condition and the health of the nation.
Yeah.
A lot of people will say, people who aren't scientists, people listening to the program, oh, these people, you know, they're doing their fun and games, the crossword, as you mentioned it, but now this is a more serious crossword because it impacts public health. What then does the structure of this permit us to do to protect the population?
Okay. So if you were a Martian and you came down onto Earth, landed on Earth, and you saw all these things which we call cars running around, he doesn't have experience of these things on Mars. So he might want to see how these humans, which he's discovered, are on Earth. How do these cars work? Would they be useful or would they be harmful to him? And what he will do is stop a car and open the hood and see what's under the hood and take it apart and put it together again and just figure out how it works. And once he knows this, he'll be able to make his own car to stop other cars working, say by putting water instead of gas into the tank or by unscrewing certain things. He'll understand what a car is like. This is what we're doing with viruses. We're trying to study exactly what it looks like, all the details, all the screws which hold it together. And by studying all the parts, we can then do something about preventing the virus from, say, infecting the next host.
Or from at least once it's infected, being destroyed before it can take hold.
Yes, yes, I mean, anything to stop.
So the knowledge of the structure predicates everything that follows, because you can see where perhaps there are weak links or where they will be receptors in the body and
stuff. Well, exactly. I mean, one of the things is that the Zika virus infects humans, and I don't know how many other types of mammals it does or does not infect, but its ability to affect anything changes what it is. And so, for instance, dengue virus causes certain kinds of disease, aches in the joints and so on. Zika virus hardly does that at all. The major problem with Zika is it does infect unborn children. How does it do that? That's how it gets into the cells. That's what we want to find out.
So now we've got the Ebola virus, the dengue virus, and now we've got the Zika. And we develop medications, we develop processes to give protection to people. Clearly that's the absolute major concentration nowadays, right? Is that going to be quicker and quicker and quicker because we're cleverer and cleverer and cleverer?
I would say yes. So we are currently looking at how antibodies, human antibodies, monkey antibodies, mouse antibodies, neutralize Zika virus. And that tells us how it can be neutralized. And the antibodies are natural defenses against viruses, including Zika viruses. So how do our natural defenses work? How can we get our natural defenses to create antibodies? That's called vaccination.
Right. Yeah. And it's taken for granted that every new virus that's down there in the future, when it infects humans, we will automatically develop some antibodies
yes,
to it.
Yeah. Well, yes, we have. All organisms have defenses against their major predator.
Yeah. Well, that's been a fascinating program, Michael Rossman, and I thank you very much for being here on Science Studio and explaining to us what you do, how you came to do it, and the importance of it. So thank you very much.
Well, I want to point out that it's not just me, far from only me. I have a colleague with whom I work very closely. His name is Richard Kuhn, and his lab and my lab work closely together. And, of course, it's not really him and me. It's really the people
well,
in our
no,
lab.
I'm sure it's not. I'm sure it's all that cadre of graduate students, postdocs. Well, that's the way science is, and yeah. I think our audience knows that. All the people that come on here, I personally don't go into the lab very often, yeah. right, except to see what's happening. But yeah. if I touch anything, people drive me out.
It drives me crazy if I don't get to the lab. I like being doing the thing, yes.
Well, I stand put in my place. Anyway, thank you very much. It's been a great program. And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting the program together. As always, take care, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the program. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.